Judges chapter 7. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod. So that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them, by the hill of Morah, in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now, therefore, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead.' And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go.' So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, 'Every one who laps from the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink, and the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. Then the Lord said to Gideon, 'By the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place.' So the people took provisions and their trumpets in their hands, and he sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. It happened on the same night that the Lord said to him, 'Arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say. And afterward your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp.' Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seashore in the multitude. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, 'I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed.' Then his companion answered and said, 'This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp.' And so it was, when Gideon heard the telling of that dream and its interpretation, that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, 'Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand.' Then he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. And he said to them, 'Look at me and do likewise. Watch, and when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp, and say, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just as they had posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers. They held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." And every man stood in his place all around the camp, and the whole army ran and cried out and fled. When the 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp, and the army fled to Beth Acacia toward Zerirah, as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tabbath. And the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites. Then Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites, and seize from them the watering places as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan." Then all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan. And they captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb. They pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan.
Thank you, Dave, for reading that. So, for Judges chapter 7, do we have anything, questions or comments, that something that stood out at them, or have any you don't quite understand? Yes, Tammy.
I guess we're kind of going backwards from the end of the chapter to the beginning, I guess, by me saying this. But one of the things that I noticed here was toward the end, when he has his 300 men that God has chosen for him, and, you know, and he, you know, tells them, you know, what to say and this kind of thing. It seems to me, if I'm catching this, unless I'm catching this wrong, the Israelite army, they did not have swords or shields. All they had were trumpets and torches.
Correct.
And pitchers.
Jugs, yeah. Some pottery jug. Yes, yeah. You're right. There were no weapons.
You know,
at this point.
In some ways, the shield thing, that not having the shield in some ways is more profound than not having the sword. Because the torch could be a weapon. But they had no shield.
Yeah.
So great, you had this torch that could be used as a weapon, yeah. But you had no shield.
God,
yes.
So God was their shield.
Yes.
So that, to me, in some ways, the fact that they
great
didn't have shields
faith.
In some ways much more profound than the fact that they didn't have swords.
Very true.
They really had no protection except the Almighty. And that's
yeah.
Pretty cool.
It is cool. Gideon, his 300 men uniquely went to battle, much the way Deborah did, but Deborah's people actually grabbed weapons. He didn't have anything except some pottery jugs, which, of course... Well, we'll get into that in a minute, and some torches and some shofars, which we'll also discuss. Yes, hey.
I always find myself when I read this, when it comes to the choosing of the people and how they drink,
yeah.
Wondering why he uses the analogy of lapping like a dog, and I'm thinking, okay, I always think, like, these are the people that aren't gonna go, you know, these are the people that are, you know, like lapping like a dog,
the other, the ones that were lapping were up and alert and looking. They were able to see and they were alert. The
were
ones
they?
That were, yeah, that's the position they were in. The ones that were on their knees, it says on their knees, but actually what they were doing is putting their face in the water. They couldn't see, so they could be easily overtaken with their face in the water, so to speak. These were up, lapping from their hands, so they were awash. They were looking and ready, not just selfishly delving into and filling their bodies with water.
Yeah.
They're still alert and paying attention.
Mm-hmm. You have secondly your comments still?
You know, like, you know, because like men who would, you know, simply stick their face in the water, I've never ever seen a man do that. Just simply stick their face in the water like that.
You depends how thirsty you are. Been there, done that. You're gonna be really thirsty, though. You, admittedly, you're very thirsty, but yeah.
No woman would do that. It would always be with a hand. You might be drinking with your hand, but it would always be with a hand. A woman would always do it with a hand. No matter how close to the ground, she might very well be laying on her belly.
That's true.
Her
she
face
might.
Is not
in the bar.
Lift up her hand.
Ain't it happen.
I want to see what's in the water.
Yeah. What am I drinking? Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions? Yeah, thanks.
The rock at Oreb.
Yes.
It sounds a lot like the split rock at Oreb that Moses dealt with.
Different spelling. Different spelling. There is not the same rock.
Not the same rock.
Oreb, O-R-E-B, or Oreb, however you wish to pronounce it, means raven or crow.
What does Oreb mean?
Horeb.
It's spelled just that way.
I forgot. What the hell does Horeb mean? Horeb. I forgot what Horeb means. But Horeb is the name of the guy. The raven is what his name is. We don't, but in years past, had various nicknames for generals. You've heard, was it what's the guy? The guy in the Northern Africa, World War II.
Desert Fox.
Desert Fox, yeah. We have nicknames for them. Oreb was the raven. That was his name. Zeb is the wolf. That's the raven and the wolf were... That's their nicknames for who they were with their military they were commanding. Different location. The rock of Horeb is not even on my map.
That's in the Saudi Arabian.
It's way, way down there.
Yeah.
This is where this little cliffs... I have this little marking here. Cliffs are... That's where Oreb, the raven, was killed.
Yeah. From 32,000 men to 300.
Yes. 32,300. Yes, that's
quite a profound reduction in manpower.
Yes, it is. It's a little bit. We look at it. It's silly. It's a joke. I mean, you can't. If I recall correctly, the Midianites numbered about 135,000 people. That includes military. Their support personnel. The leaders, about 135,000 going up against 300. Yes, Bill.
Is this where he says, be still and see the salvation of the Lord, or is it along that same line where...
He doesn't say this.
So I can show you who's doing why here.
There is motive in God's actions here, which he explicitly discusses and he tells it during this chapter. His intention is to obviously cause a victory, but make it so completely obvious that human beings didn't do it. His issue, which has been in years prior, judges prior, is that the people get a little complacent that, hey, we're strong. Hey, we're doing really well. Hey, we can handle this. It's along the same lines of the post that was published in the synagogue here in Santa Rosa. We willed it. And yeah. It happened regarding the reestablishment of the country or nation of Israel.
Isn't that the Zionist kind of mentality?
In some ways, it's like, hey, we want to do this. God, be with us or not. Thus, it happened because we wanted it to happen. It's a self-grandizement, something that God did not want in this particular victory. It was important for them not to have it. They've had that for Deborah's victory, which was 40 years of tranquility, and they got really, really, really bad by the end of it. Keep in mind that, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, God raised up Midian, and it points out in Gideon when he was first selected by God, that they were encountering a scenario that it wasn't that Midian wanted the land, it wasn't that Midian wanted the crops. Midian just wanted all Israelites dead. That was their motive, that was their goal. That's a different kind of enemy versus ones which you fight because, well, they want power, or they want money, or they want territory. Midian, God raised up just to kill Israelites.
Were Midianites Arabs?
No, Arabs, that's a modern term. Midianites are literally Midian. They're just...
They're descendants of Abraham. Correct.
Yeah. Well...
Yep.
Yes, but Abraham, that's right. The descendants of Abraham. Not direct, no.
But they're
like their second,
the,
like the second grandchild or something like that.
Child.
No.
No. It was a second marriage. After Sarah died.
Yeah.
Oh, Sarah, okay.
Yeah, Abraham's like it's his second wife. I believe so. I believe it was the second wife, right? It wasn't Ishmael's descendants. Yes, Moses' father-in-law was a Midianite priest. Yes. Not all Midianites are evil. It's just that they were into war with somebody that God raised up to do a task. So there are roughly 135,000 soldiers and personnel in the camp of Midian and Amalek and all the other kings of the east area that have converged together in my little green spot here called
Jezreel Valley.
We've heard that many times. And we will again. It pops up over and over and over again. As I mentioned before, it is a great location. Empty plains. Easy to see long distances. Easy to get in and out of. Because it had two main entrances. And obviously both two exits. And you can access the ocean if you're seafaring people from Jezreel Valley. Or you can access the Jordan River without even having to climb a single mountain or single hill. It's right, easy, straight shot. So easy for armies to come in. And also easy to get themselves trapped. Because what's on both sides of the Jezreel Valley?
Mountains.
Mountains. Hills. Which you don't climb. Which, of course, where Gideon's men were. They were in the mountains and hills. Same place where Deborah's men were when they showed up. They were in the mountains and the hills above Jezreel Valley near Megiddo area. And they travel down, go to battle, and win. Of course, with God's hand. So, they're in the Jezreel Valley, this little green spot up here. I have, along my little map, these two little green lines that kind of dot over to my little black Jordan River. Jordan's not really black, but that's just how I drew it. Herod's Valley. Herod's Valley is roughly the same altitude as Jezreel Valley, give or take maybe 100 feet or so. That's where the armies travel to and from. They pass this area. This is the location. This little Herod's Valley is where their army of the Midianites fled through. Same place that Sisera fled through with Deborah. They all flee that way. And where does it go to? The Jordan River, which ultimately to their death. But that's another symbolism. They travel down Herod's Valley, which is called Herod, obviously, after King Herod, who's named that many, many years later. But I'm just using the same term. Once they reach the Jordan River, they head straight down because this is a nice, easy shot. Because where is Midian located at this point in time? Way over here. Which, if you, a little further down. If you need to flee and you need to go home quickly, how do you get there?
Boat.
In this case, he's going to travel from the Jezreel Valley down through Herod's Valley, down the Jordan River, and then cut across Gad. That's the flee. That's the direction they can. Yes.
He's a long way from home.
Well, really not that. I mean, you can get that. If you're driving, you can get there maybe in 2 hours max. I mean, yes, it's not like it's an instantaneous 5-minute trip.
Walk up and run.
Well, we don't know if they actually took boats along the Jordan River or not.
They had camels and
that. Yeah, they had but they also left a lot of that material during the battle, so we don't know. Anyway, so this is the route he takes. Their intention is to travel across Gad. Most of them do travel across Gad into Midian. That's their ultimate location. Where is Amalek, the other country that's with them, the other military? They're further south, below Judah. They're going to take the same route, though. Because it's easy. It's fast. They travel the same route. They come across Jordan River, come down, cross Gad, and down here, it's nice, easy travel down. They can bypass the Dead Sea. They don't have to mess with getting into Reuben's territory or anyone. Gad's too weak at this point anyway to do much. They travel all the way down and can go home. It's an easy route to evacuate from, which is what they did.
They tried to.
The things they didn't count on is who owns this territory at this point in time. Manasseh owns it. Both sides, nations of Manasseh own it. Gad owns it, but at this point they're kind of weak in their history. And Ephraim is one of the most dominant tribes of the north at this point. Mind you, we're getting into a story or period of Ephraim's time, the northern tribes, the northern tribes of Israel's time, where Ephraim is trying to exert some dominance. We already have a point where Judah is strong right now, and they get stronger when the kings show up. But at this point, Ephraim has been, they were complaining with Joshua, hey, we're bigger than this, we need more territory. He said, fine, go conquer it, and it's yours. They didn't. But that was the condition. They are very large. Ephraim's getting pretty big. They start, at this point, next chapter, they're going to complain. The fact, hey, how come we weren't in the fight? Now, granted, they were in the fight at the tail end of this story, which is how Gideon gets out of this whole finagling, talking them out of anger. But they actually go to war against a few of their other tribes in the future because they're exerting their own dominance. They become the predominant tribe of all of northern Israel. It is Ephraim, essentially. That's what we call Ephraimites. We always use that term. Lost 10 tribes, all dominated by Ephraim. Of course, Judah is dominating the south. So Ephraim's trying to exert a little muscle power at this point in time. But anyway, Jezreel Valley's up north. Manasseh is invited to the party, naturally, because who's Gideon from? Manasseh. Naphtali gets invited to the party as well. So does Asher. I believe Zebulun does too, if I recall correctly. Hold on a second, I'm just double checking. No, Zebulun does not. Zebulun and Issachar kind of left off the story. It's not a really big time in their lives anyway. They were big with Deborah. They were most of the military might during Deborah's time 40 years earlier. At this time, they're not so strong. They get invited to the party. Ephraim does not get invited to the party. They're told at the end of it, oh, hey, by the way, we need your help because some people are heading down your way. But they weren't invited. They got a little bent from it, which we'll get into that as well. But before we get all there, all the way through the end of the chapter here, we'll go back a little bit. I commented about God performs the miracle as far as verse 2. He starts talking to Gideon about this, what he actually wants. It says, the people that are with you are too numerous for me to deliver Midian into their hand, lest Israel aggrandize or exalt itself over me, saying, my own strength has saved me. So I'll call these appearing, say, people say, whoever fears and trembles, make them go home. This is exactly what the Torah says. If you amass an army, people you send home, amongst many groups that you send home, the people who fear are one of those groups. Go home. Now, Gideon does it very tactfully. He points out, says, depart at dawn or by dawn from Mount Gilead. They go home at night. No one has to see you're leaving. No one has to ridicule you while you're gone. But by dawn, leave. So they do. 22,000. Granted, we're debatable with 1,000 in clan. It doesn't really matter. But we'll deal with the numbers as they're directly translated right now. 1,000 people withdrew. Basically, almost two-thirds of his group. 10,000 remain. And then, of course, that's still too many. Bring him down to the water. And this one goes with you, he'll go, and whoever I see separates, of course, we just read that, the whole dog lapping water or on your hands and knees. There is a lot of debate about this. Why? What was the big deal about lapping like a dog with your hands lapping or on your knees with face in the water?
My observation would be, the first one would be self-absorbed, and the other one would be looking out for the one another.
Which one's which?
Well, the one laying on their belly, thinking of their own self getting the water, would be self-absorbed. And the other one that is on their knees and drinking water this way, they can look in either direction and look out for their fellow man.
Who's on their belly?
The self-absorbed one.
The belly is not specified here.
No one was on their belly.
No one's on their belly.
He made that comment,
and Dave made the comment. Well, no, it's not this illegitimate comment. In many, many commentaries, they discuss the debate. Well, if someone's on their knees drinking water, what's the other person doing drinking water out of a river? They must be on their belly, because they can't be on their knees. The people on their knees were gotten rid of.
They can't reach down there.
Yeah, they can't reach down there if they're standing up. So they determined it must be... The commentary was basically, oh, one must be knees, one must be belly. No, there's a third, which she just pointed out.
Squatting
down, scooping up, drinking. Not very many did that, obviously. Only 300 did that. What was his purpose? Now, Jewish commentary rails against the people that got down on their knees versus those who squatted. And they have their reasons for it. Christian commentary has their own reasons, which I don't completely understand because it varies a lot from Christian religion to religion. They have their own philosophy behind it. It's a little more difficult to grasp. I don't have a complete answer, but I'll give you at least what the Jewish commentary says. It says, well, looking at the context of what was happening during Gideon's lifetime, how many people were idol worshippers?
A lot.
Gideon was. His whole family was. The vast majority were probably idol worshippers. Who would give credit to a victory to what? An idol, rather than to God. And thus, the few that weren't, 300 men, would give victory or glory to God for the victory. Now, how does laying on one or kneeling down on their knees versus squatting, how does that distinguish? Well, this is their belief. They believed that it wasn't kneeling, it was how they knelt, as you would kneel to your idol you pray to every day.
Yeah.
It was the style in which they used.
You know, the water, they represent much of, you know, for plants and water and crops. So it's a related substance to the idol they were worshiping.
Very true. Very exactly. That would be consistent with the whole area of Jezreel Valley is that way. You had your hand up, Tammy.
The other thing is that if it is a difference between squatting and kneeling versus, let's say, kneeling and laying
down
a
belly, right?
Then if you think about it, going back to what people were analyzing a little bit about preparedness for attack, would be that if you're on your knees, then to get up, you have to put your hands down on the ground and then get up. Whereas if you're already on your feet, you just pop up.
You pop up, yes. They're very true. Militarily speaking, that squatting is a better stance to be in if you're going to be doing one or the other. Yes, Bill.
Seems to me they couldn't all be doing that at one time. There'd be somebody standing guard while they're down there doing that.
Gideon was probably standing guard. No, there's only 300 that were selected, and we don't know if there was somebody else standing guard and beyond that.
What that we don't know, we have victory, we think they're all did all at once. That may not be going on. He may have sent this group down, and then that group, they might have been...
To wean them out over the course of the
day. Yeah, right.
Now, naturally, of course, he does not inform them of his weeding out process, because... Then those who would, they would obviously know ahead of time, they would do accordingly. He informs them afterwards, so it's just a matter of how they function. That is Jewish philosophy point of what they say. There's got to be some reason why God did this, because God was adamant. He wanted the glory, not Israel, and obviously no other idol was going to get the glory for this one. Very big about that. He discussed that at the beginning of the chapter, also in part of chapter 6 as well, that God says, hey, I deserve the glory, I'm the one doing the work. It's important to know. That's Jewish philosophy. Christian philosophy, which I didn't get a full, really clean picture of, but they seem to argue along the lines of, which was the belly and the knees comment, that those who were on their belly, similar to how the Jewish interpreted it, were less concerned with the welfare of their fellow man. May or may not be true, I don't know. It's a little difficult to argue that because there's no other evidence beyond it. It's just kind of just there. The other philosophy is there was some evidence because of what God's comments were earlier about him wanting the glory, not man or idols, for that matter, when he talked to chapter 6. Idols were not going to get his glory. They had some reason behind it. Christian philosophy at that point, this one comment that I ran across, didn't really have great arguments backing it up. So I can't tell you definitively what the answer is. Why God chose these methods. Whatever they were still going to accomplish his ultimate goal, which was to glorify him rather than anyone or anything else. Yes, Ellie.
At this point in time, it does not sound like their instruction from God is to not be self-centered. It sounds like the instruction for God is don't bow down to idols.
Up to this point, that is true. That through all of chapter 6, that is consistent.
Right. And it could be also the fact that few people drink the water in this one manner when more people drink the water in that manner, and he just
needed
to
a little bit.
It
could be. That's bottom line. Could be very simple. Yes.
Well, and I know some very loving people that just don't have any common sense. So just because you don't have common sense doesn't mean that you're, you know... A self-absorbed
somebody. Very true. I would hope not. Else most of us would be in a lot of hot water. Okay, so we're going to get beyond this point for a little while. So he weeds them out. The 10,000 get whittled down to the 300. Now it says, of course, he sent them all home. He left provisions, though. Of those 10,000, a percent of those provisions were left. What provisions were left? The empty jugs.
The shofars,
and the torches. We're going to get into that in a minute, because those are three key items that show up here that are tools that God used that were fantastic for their symbolism and their action. We'll discuss that shortly. But at least those three, because I'm sure their food was probably left, a few of the items, tents were probably left. Granted, most of these people were hiding in the mountain range, hiding in the hills, so you're kind of limited on space and where you're going to put up a tent, but you can do some. What's happening? This, by the way, this is believed to have taken, as far as the weeding out process, about 2 to 3 days. That's believed. Because it's just consistent with what's happening. The story flow, it consists about 2 to 3 days. It could have taken longer, but I tend not to believe it took a little longer. What's Midian seeing during these 3 days?
People going home.
People going home. Aren't they? You can't hide 32,000 men, can you?
No.
Good luck. I don't care how many mountain ranges you have, you can't hide 32,000 men. It's not that easy to hide. So Midian, who's in the valley below, they're looking up, and they can see these guys. They can see all these huge mass of people. They may not go up to battle because it's on a mountain range, but they can see them at least, and they're seeing them go home. What does that do to Midian?
Puffs them up.
Puffs them up really, really nice and really big.
Yeah. Oh, we can whip these guys
when
up.
You know you cannot be defeated, what do you then do?
You relax.
You relax.
Yeah.
You relax, which you get careless, as she pointed out. How is it that Gideon and his servants are able to enter the Midianite camp?
They weren't seen as a threat.
They weren't seen as a threat. No one saw them come in, or if they did see them, they didn't recognize who they were. They weren't being looked at. It was no big deal. Close enough to hear a conversation. And then leave again. Again, no attacking, no nothing.
I think it's interesting that God actually picked He tells Gideon, either go by yourself, or if you're going to go with somebody, go with this particular person.
Very true. Gideon, which we discussed in Round Across in chapter 6, he's not like a cowardly person, but he can be fearful. It's not that fear, being full of fear is bad. As long as you know how to use it, it's fine. Joshua points out he was afraid at times, but he knew how to use it. He was doing fine. God was on his side. Gideon, chapter 6 indicates his fear because he took care of the idol and the Asherah tree and the altar at night when nobody was awake. It just popped up in the morning. Oh, hey, look, it's already done. You can't stop it now. You can't undo it. And then, of course, then his father stands up for him. So he has an element of fear in him, meaning his character is not very strong. And, of course, this is a downfall in the next chapter. Lack of strong character can hurt you, and it does for Gideon's case. So him being fearful, God knew that of him, I believe, which is why God said, hey, if you're afraid, which if I had 300 men and I was going against 135,000, yeah, I'm going to be afraid too. Likelihood of my survival is very, very, very small. So I would be afraid as well, which naturally he is. That makes sense.
I'm more concerned once I only have 300
left. Exactly. Well,
you can't learn bravery unless you're in severe danger.
That's true. It does not come naturally otherwise, or it doesn't come naturally as a general rule. So, we're down. He says, all right, go take a look at it itself. He hears this dream. What was the dream?
Barley loaf.
Yeah. Now, English translates this one way. There's another, Judaism translates it differently. Neither way are right or wrong. They're just slightly different as far as what the item was. English says it's a cake of barley loaf. Or what was like a baked barley loaf. Judaism says, well, actually the term is a roasted barley loaf. Why does that matter? Who cares? Well, if you know what roasted means in Hebrew, it tells you the time of year this is happening.
Yeah.
Because roasted only happens about 3 days or so of the Israelite year. Roasted means empty.
Means what?
Roasted means empty. Something that is hollow inside in Hebrew when it comes to roasted barley. When does that occur? Does anybody recall?
Spring.
Spring, in particular?
Days of Unleavened Bread.
Days of Unleavened Bread. About 2 days before.
Yeah.
Days of Unleavened Bread, for Passover. That's what it's for. Barley grows. We all know it grows. It grows like grass. And it is just a grass. There's nothing really impressive about it. But there's about 2 to 3 days where the seed is just beginning to form. Early on in that seed's form, it's hollow. You touch it, you squish it, there's nothing in there. If you try to cook it, it will produce nothing you can eat. 3 days later, you can now eat it. It will now actually produce a real seed that actually has starches in it that you can crush and turn into bread. That wave sheaf offering is right at that transition point, which is it just turned from roast, I mean empty. Roasted means if you tried to burn it, there's nothing left. That's where the term roasted. If it's not roasted, but you burn it, there is something less that is no longer roasted. that's why it comes empty versus not. That's what the term means. So it just transitioned from empty to full. It's now a real grain now. That's to say, all right, this is a vision that God's giving to these people, to these few soldiers. Time of year is Passover. Or it's just the beginning of Passover. I also happen to like the barley grain itself, the wild barley grain. There's a very unique symbolism to it. It symbolizes Judaism or Israelites as a whole. That's its function. They are the earliest, the beginning. They're the ones that God selected, because what do you do with barley? The high priests go out there and say, okay, this isn't ready, this isn't ready, this isn't ready. I finally found a batch. I cut it off. I've selected it. The symbolism works fairly well, how I view it at least, with regards to Israel, because that's who they were. They were selected by God. Not because they were good or bad or anybody else was worse. They were just chosen.
Why there's only 300.
Yes, and why they're called chosen people. They're chosen. They were selected. So barley represents them in many ways. As opposed to, for example, wheat. What do Christians associate wheat with?
A lot.
Wheat is usually associated with
the harvest
of everybody, or bread, the souls. We associate wheat with ourselves as a general rule. So there's a difference between Shavuot, that's what it is. It is, barley is typically symbolism of Israel versus wheat being symbolism of Christianity or the nations. So I like the symbols. So that's why Judaism points out, hey, this actually says roasted, thus it's probably during Passover this is occurring. That's why I think it's important. I thought it was funny that they used that term. And it was barley, not just any grain, because it was Israel that was symbolic of. Gideon's thrilled to hear this. He takes off with Purah, goes back and says, God deliver them. Yes, Ellie.
That's why the companion knew it was Gideon. The guy that had the dream knew.
He knew who it was.
He knew that's
Gideon. He knew the interpretation.
Yeah. That Israelites.
That's Israelites. Those barley people. Because at Gideon's time, they're religious people as well. What do they see Israel doing every year?
Waving barley.
Waving barley every spring, which they don't do. But Israel does. It's a really oddity thing they do. They wave barley every spring. They do a lot of strange things. So this just happens to be one of them. As far as Midian's concerned, they're strange items. Okay, let's see, go past that verse. Let's see, verse...
How did he killed just after that?
Who? Well, Gideon?
Yeah. He's in the middle of the camp. He's talking. He has this dream. His servants all, oh, this means Gideon's sword is going to kill all you guys.
Yeah.
Oh, cool, come back to your camp.
And, yes, exactly. It's God's hand. It's a little bit, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, if I entered an enemy camp and I was close enough to hear the conversation and its interpretation and not sweat about being killed.
It's like something you see in a comedy, you know, it's just wandering around the
enemy. Granted, it is quite a unique scenario that he happens to be in. So,
it sounds to me like Gideon is hearing the Midianite and his companion is the companion he's talking to that is interpreting the dream, not the one that took Gideon.
No. You're right. It is the Midianite who had the dream, and the Midianite companion interpreted it. Okay. But Gideon's right there listening, and Puah, his servant, is right there next to them.
Right.
Or near him.
They're all
listening to this conversation. That's difficult to do. Now, granted, they are not in a territory where they have televisions or photographs or wanted posters. They wouldn't know what Gideon looked like other than his dress or his garb, whatever he had clothing he had on, which he did wasn't armed, so he probably didn't have a whole lot. So it's just the fact they got so close to it is the unique thing, that they were able to do that. Because why? Midianites saw 32,000 Israelites flee. That's how Gideon got so close. They had nothing to worry about, did they? We just said, what is that? That puffs you up. You let your guard down. It's not a big deal. We don't worry about these pathetic few.
You guys come in and look around and see how powerful.
Yeah, exactly. No kidding. Might brag a little bit while you're at it. Okay.
These guys are coming in, they're unarmed anyway. Yeah. So let them come in, take a little look around. They can, we got all of our swords and chariots or camels or this and that.
Nothing to, they have nothing, literally nothing to fear at this point. I'm going to write down my little map here. Gideon, in verse 16. Of course, he goes back, tells Israel, into your hand, come, let's all go to war, do as I do. Verse 16, he divides the 300 men into three companies, presumably 100 apiece. It may not have been even, it doesn't really matter. Where did they go? Three companies, into the hand, he gave all of them shofars, empty jugs, with torches inside the jugs. The torches are lit, by the way. They're inside the jug, but they're lit. They're not lit. They're not out. So, divide into three groups. Now, I discussed earlier, just shortly ago, where are they all going to flee? Where's this big army going to flee through?
Herod's Valley.
So, if you have three companies, and you want them to go one direction, you surround them on the three remaining sides, right? Yeah. So, most of Gideon's men originally were in the near Megiddo, or the western, southwestern area of Jezreel Valley, but they had their little 100 over here, about 100 over here, and about 100 over there, leaving one direction left unopened. Easy travel through, just funnel them in to their own destruction. Makes life simple. Okay, there are three tools, which I like these tools. They're pretty cool. In the military, at this time, what does a torch mean? What is it used for?
Light.
Light. Does everybody in the military have a torch?
No.
Who has the torch in the middle of the night? Usually the one you're following has a torch. That's a general rule. That's the one you're following, right? You can't see. He's got the torch. Follow the torch. He'll be fine. General rule, that's the case. What about a shofar? Does anybody have a shofar in the... No. We have the same. We have a bugle boy, we call him, or people who are bugle. Same principle. Who has it?
Or they should have drums.
Hip or drums. This is a long time ago. We don't do it today, but they did it then. Who has these instruments?
Usually
the ones in front. Probably the guy next to the one with the torch, most likely. Marching the army along. Now, what is a shofar supposed to be used for? Call to battle means attack now. That's what it's usually used, it's demonstrated for, in military purposes. So, what about jugs, empty jugs? What do they do?
They carry things,
but they're empty.
Collect water along the way.
Now, the torch is hidden inside of them.
But they're going to make a lot of noise when they drop them on the ground.
Make a lot of noise, that's the key. Mm-hmm. Torch is hidden inside them, torch is lit, okay? Hiding the light. You're all going, 100 guys standing up, however, I don't know how far apart they are spaced, doesn't really make much difference. 100 guys on each side. They have these jugs, and they have these torches in the shofar. They take the jug, and they break it. Now, most of us have been at home, and we break something, or we hear something broken in the kitchen. What's our instantaneous reaction?
Knee jerk.
What happened? Is everybody okay? Something wrong? It does. It is a sound that is quite unique. Well, as a general rule, my response is not. Usually it gets my attention quickly, and something went wrong. It go clean it up, go fix it, hopefully nobody's cut or hurt. It startles you. That's its function. It startles you, doesn't it? Whatever you're doing, something happened. Assuming you're not the one who broke it. If that's the case, the Midianite army, Gideon breaks his jug first, right? What's that first going to do with a bunch of people who are deep asleep?
Wake
them up. Then everybody else breaks their glasses and jugs. What does that do? Startlement starts showing up. Holy cow, something's happening. A lot of jugs are breaking, a lot of glasses breaking, which is usually the sound of an attack. If somebody's attacking your camp, what's going to break? Tents are going to break, wood's going to break, glass jugs are going to break, or pottery jugs, they're going to break. Crash, things are going to get destroyed. So Gideon startles them with his little quick little crush, which of course alerts the rest of the guys to the same thing. And then all the rest of them start breaking up their jugs, and what's then revealed?
Light.
A lot of torches. Okay, now let's think of the minds of a Midianite soldier. Oh, yes, Dave.
Well, usually, not everybody in an army is carrying a torch. And because there's only 300 and they all have torches, from a Midianite's perspective, they're thinking of many.
There's a lot of guys behind them. Exactly. If I look at it, I see this whole wall of guys with torches. I'm in the middle of military, this middle of the night, I'm anticipating there's more guys behind them following.
And being below them.
You're also looking up. You're looking up. They're in a valley, so you're looking up. These guys are coming down. Or actually, they came to a certain point. I don't know how far down they came. It is. And it doesn't hurt the fact it's the middle of the night and everybody's kind of dozy and not really paying too close attention. And you have all these torches, see the light, the sound. They know what a sound means. That means attack. You've got, from all three sides, huge vibration of sound of shofars being blasted at you in the middle of the night. You're hearing jugs break, and you're seeing light from torches, which you naturally, in your training, know is you are being attacked from all three sides. Run.
It's not the welcoming committee, then.
It's not the welcoming committee. Run. Now, the Midianites saw the 32,000 Israelites flee or run or take off days earlier, but they don't know if they didn't just regroup and hide in the hills for an. They don't know. It's the middle of the night, exactly. The guards just got changed. The new guys aren't even paying attention to what just happened. They're, just woke up from their stupor, whatever they were doing before when they were asleep, and the guys who were there just went down. So it's a perfect timing, great tools were left by those 32,000 men. So had those 32,000 men not shown up, would there have been as many shofars? Maybe, but probably not. Because usually a shofar per company, typically, or per group has their own shofar. Not everybody does. So they left their provisions, allowing this wonderful, perfectly designed attack by God to fall through. Now what did the 300 men do? They broke the jugs. Revealing their light, which of course in itself is startling, and they're blasting their shofars, and they all stood still.
They yelled,
made noise. They didn't go attack, did they? They had no weapons. It's kind of hard to back no weapons. Some of torches, but you don't want to use that because your torch might go out. They didn't have to. What is a shofar also used for, other than just your own men going to battle? Well, it's supposed to be symbolic of calling to God.
Right.
Because what did the people hear when they were at the Ten Commandments, the mountain, the burning mountain? What did they hear?
The voice of God.
Voice of God. What did it sound like?
Trumpets.
Trumpets or loud blasts in their ears. It's a symbolism of God speaking or talking to God or from Him. So that tells all the angels that God has instilling these men. Because it's one thing to just grab your stuff and run, as all this Midianite army is doing. It's something else to grab yourself and kill anyone in your way while you're running.
Right.
There's a little bit different requirement there to actually take short and kill people and poke them as you're going around. Exactly. You had the wonderful conversation that your servant just interpreted for you that said, it was Gideon. I mean, it takes a little bit more to have that happen. That is God's hand. Because Gideonite's men didn't do anything. I mean, technically, they didn't do squat. You look at it, if you look from the outside, just observe, well, nothing happened. But God fought. He killed, in the next chapter, like 120-some-odd thousand Midianite soldiers at that camp. That takes a lot to do that, as far as men don't do that. But God does. And He does it not only here, He does it many times in the future. That's why He's going through this. It's one of his little handiwork touches He's got. He may have raised the army up, doesn't mean He likes the army. Okay. Where'd they run to? The balance, the ones who survived this whole onslaught of Gideon's men. They ran to this valley. Now I have my little red cities here. Abel, Meloa, and Zerera. There's another pronounced, the other spelling, it's Zeretta is actually what it's supposed to be. Just here pronounced, the R looks like a D sometimes, so they translate it as Zerera instead of Zeretta. Same location. It's the mouth of Jabbok River. This comes into play in the next chapter. Because this is in Gad's territory. And Gad didn't do things they should have done. Some people didn't. Like I mentioned before, they're kind of weak at this point. Well, they own some cities, they own some towns along this area who did not lend their services to Gideon's men when they should have. They get punished for it later. So it's important to know where these are located because you know who actually gets strung up, essentially. Not all of Gad, just certain towns. They come down here in this area. Now, Ebel Meloah, I have a little dot here as a city. It's about 27 miles south of Galilee. It's actually a territory, like an area. Like, for example, Santa Rosa Plain. It's actually a very large area. It includes Santa Rosa, a bunch of other cities or towns as well. But it's a large area. This if I can pronounce it properly. Ebel Meoah covers a territory, although it's on this side of Jordan, meaning the west side of Jordan, covers territory, includes part of Gad's territory. It's like an area. Do you have any name to that particular town? Not that it really matters to most of us, but this is where both men were killed. The bee, the wolf, and the raven were killed in this town's area. It shows up again. There are a couple. I think there's one of the kings is born here, and some of the prophets is also from here, from that area, that territory. And the Psalms discuss it as well. So the rock of Oreb, where is that? My little dot here. See where the Jabbok are by Jabbok River and the Zerera is? These little lines here where the cliffs are. I have wrote down cliffs kind of in a vertical form. They're really not cliffs. It's about being a couple hundred feet up, but really, really long, far distances. What'd they do? Hey, Oreb, want to swim? Push. you just kill them there at the cliff. It's actually these areas, or these rock is one particular rock, which protrudes up relatively conspicuous. It's really odd thing just pops up in the middle of these cliffs. Probably where he was killed at. Of course, beheaded. Wine press of the wolf, Zev. No one knows where it's at. It's just a wine press named after him. It could be that the wine press was named before and then he was named after the wine press. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't make much difference. In the same area, all killed by Ephraim. Because Gideon, who makes them all run down here and head south, all of Manasseh's men went home. They're not ready to fight. They were amongst the 32,000 men that God said, go home. Who wasn't there? Ephraim. Which, good thing he wasn't. They may have gone home too. He wasn't. They said, hey, go take this little crossing of the Jabbok River, which is where all these guys are heading to go home, as mentioned before. Go back to Midian, go back, regroup, go back down south to where Amalek's territory is. Ephraim's men come, they take the Jabbok River, the Zera area, the cliffs, which is basically occupied. They already owned it, but just showing up there. Of course, capture them and kill them. Let's see, what does it actually matter to these discuss this? Ephraim's little selfish commentary. So in verse 25, they captured two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb. They killed Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. They pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon across the Jordan. The next chapter, Ephraim discusses their anger, that they weren't part of this original battle. They wanted to kill people. Fair is fair, right? Yes, this is a little tactfully put. But why would God not have wanted Ephraim there? Tammy.
He wanted them to be the backup. Because he knew that he was going to weed them out of the original battle. He knew he was only one of 300 men in the original battle. But he also knew that these men would flee and they needed to be taken out too. So you got your men at the rear to do the cleanup. And who better than Ephraim, right? Because they're coming right down.
They're coming right down to you. Exactly.
You didn't have to go meet up with them.
They came to you. Exactly. It was perfect. It was well planned. Yes, Hank.
They also would have took the wind out of their sails if they had known about it from the beginning and this, that, you know, because they had the spite of surprise,
That's true.
And being spurred into it.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Catching up to what's going on.
And the other thing is that when the Manassehites and some of those other folks were in that original battle or possibly facing that other battle, you were looking at 32,000 men facing 135,000.
Yeah.
But now, I don't know how many Ephraimites were in the ultimate battle at the end, but they're only dealing with, what, maybe at this point, 15,000, 20,000 men?
Probably about 10,000, 15,000, yeah.
Because 120,000
God killed here.
So this is the remainder. So this is maybe 10,000 to 20,000 men left over coming
exactly.
down. That's a lot different odds than
that's very true.
300.
Very
yeah,
true.
Maybe 10,000 to, I don't know, a few thousand Ephraimites or whatever. The odds look a little bit...
A little easier better. To attack. And it had God had asked that question of how many you were afraid, and you know, that... Not 22,000 would have gone home, a whole lot less, but the same principle. That had Ephraim been part of the original group, they probably would have gone home, thus disqualifying them to assist
later
on. Because Gad, which we'll discuss in a minute, they've been disqualified all along. We'll discuss that in the next chapter. Gad doesn't count. They can't help. Judah, as I mentioned before, is always perpetually fighting Philistines. They can't do squat with this whole territory, so they're on their own. Dan, same deal. They're perpetually fighting Philistines. All their spare soldiers and spare men are down there attacking and killing, with few exceptions. Still, who's left if Ephraim's knocked out of the option? If they had shown up here, well, you got, what, Benjamin? Reuben? Come on. Reuben wouldn't even fight in Deborah's battle when the odds were great. They're not going to fight in this one either. Benjamin's too small at this point. They're still growing. They were a small tribe to start with. They stayed relatively small. They can't fight much at all, much either. So it was perfect that Ephraim stayed out of the original battle. They would have been sent home. And as I mentioned at the beginning of my commentary today, Ephraim is just beginning to elbow some dominance here. If I want to elbow dominance and become the main tribe, I'm going to glorify myself anytime I talk to you about me. That's going to happen, which is precisely what God said he did not want, that they would glorify themselves and not give glory to God for this. And what did Ephraim do? Ephraimites, the men, did they glorify God? No, they didn't. Even after this whole battle, the 120-some had been dead, all they focused on, well, at least we got the two most important people.
They can't reform an army.
Yeah. What was that?
They could not reform their army if they captured them.
Well, no, that's true. That's true. But instead of giving glory to God for God killing 120-some-odd-thousand men, they focused on what they did. Well, look what we did. Instead of saying, look what God delivered into our hand. Mm-hmm. There's a difference there. Like I said, Ephraim's beginning to push a little bit and grow and try to take over some tribes. And they attempt it, and like I said before, they'll get into a battle, they'll lose it, but they'll get into a battle anyway, later on. That's all I had to say. Any questions or comments? Something you had a question about or a discussion?
Geographically, Ephraim's in a perfect spot to thrive.
Yes, they are.
They're right in the
They're surrounded by
of all the
protection.
Tribes.
Yeah. They're in a great location. It's not the most fertile location. The fertile is up here in the Jezreel Valley, and along, but they're still fairly close to the Jordan River, Jordan Valley. They're protected on all sides from all attacks. They have to go to somebody else first. So they are a perfect place to thrive, which is probably one of the reasons why they did thrive. Any other comments or questions? Thank you for your time.